The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I won't say good night, because my English improved a lot since the first time I came to the United States. And it was in New York, and I began the reading, I don't remember the year, but some years ago, saying, good night. And everybody laughed. And I said, they are really nice people. So now I'm saying good evening. And thanks for coming. And as we are all in Philadelphia now. Philadelphia was the first capital of the new nation, the independent United States. I would like to dedicate this reading to a forgotten Founding Father, because this is the book of the forgotten, these mirrors I wrote. Robert Carter was buried in the garden. In his will he asked, quote, to be laid under a shady tree where he might be undisturbed, and sleep in peace and obscurity, no stone nor inscription. End of the quote. This Virginia patrician was one of the richest, if not the richest, of all the prosperous landowners who broke ties with England. Although several other founding fathers looked askance at slavery, none of them freed their slaves. Carter was the only one to unchain the 450 blacks he owned, quote, to allow them to live and work according to their own will and pleasure. He freed them 70 years before Abraham Lincoln abolished slavery, and he did so gradually, taking care that none was simply turned out and deserted. Such folly condemned him to solitude and oblivion. He was cut off by his friends, his neighbors, and his family, all of whom were convinced that free blacks were a threat to personal and national security. Later on, his acts were rewarded with collective amnesia. And I'll begin explaining the container, the cover of the book. And after, the contents, even if this story about Robert Carter was part of the contents, of course. It's a beautiful cover, a beautiful face, marvelous. And this is the story of the cover. West African sculptors have always sung while they worked, and they do not stop singing until their sculptures are finished. That way the music gets inside the carvings and keeps on singing. In 1910, Leo Frobenius found ancient sculptures on the Slave Coast that made his eyes bulge. Their beauty was such that the German explorer believed they were Greek, brought from Athens, or perhaps from the lost Atlantis. And his colleagues agreed, Africa, daughter of a scorn, mother of slaves, could not have produced such marvels. It did, though. Those music-filled effigies had been sculpted a few centuries previous in the belly bottom of the world, in Ife, the sacred place where the Yoruba gods gave birth to women and men. Africa turned out to be an unending wellspring of art, art worth celebrating and worth stealing. It seems Paul Gauguin, a rather absent-minded fellow, put his name on a couple of sculptures from the Congo, and the error was contagious. From then on, Picasso, Modigliani, Klee, Giacometti, Ernst Mohr, and many, many other European artists made the same mistake, and did so with alarming frequency. Pillaged by its colonial masters, Africa would never know how responsible it was for the most astonishing achievements in 20th century European art. Another short story who is also a good way to enter into the book, to, in a certain way, explain it. How would the Trojan War have been told by an unknown soldier? A Greek foot soldier, ignored by the gods and desired only by the vultures that circles the battlefields. A farmer fighter, hymned by no one and sculptured by no one, nobody and everybody, obliged to kill and without the slightest interest in being killed to win Helen's eyes. Would that soldier have predicted what Euripides later confirmed, that Helen never was in Troy, only her shadow, that 10 years of butchery occurred for the sake of an empty tunic? And if that soldier survived, what would he recall? Who knows? Maybe the smell. The smell of pain, and only that. 3,000 years after the fall of Troy, war correspondents Robert Fisk and Fran Sevilla tell us that wars stink. They have been, both of them have been in several wars on the inside, and they know the hot, sweet, sticky stench of decay that gets into your pores and takes up residence in your body, that nausea that never goes away. Being as it is, a book of the invisibles, about the invisibles, I suppose you will understand the next story I'm going to tell. There they are, painted on the walls and roofs of caves. Bison, elk, bears, horses, seagulls, women, men. These figures are ageless. They were born thousands upon thousands of years ago, but they are born again every time someone looks at them. How could he, our ancestor of long ago, paint so delicately? How could a brute who fought wild beasts with his bare hands create images so filled with grace? How did he manage to draw those flying lines that break free of the stone and take to the air? How could he? Or was it she? The symbols of the French Revolution are female. Women of marble or bronze with powerful naked breasts, Phrygian caps, flags aflutter. But what the revolution produced was the declaration of the rights of man and the citizen. And when revolutionary militant Olympe de Gouges proposed the Declaration of the Rights of Woman and the Female Citizen, she was hauled off to jail. A revolutionary tribunal found her guilty, and the guillotine removed her head. At the foot of the scaffold, Olympe asked, If we women have the right to go to the guillotine, should we not also have the right to go to the tribune? Not allowed. They could not speak, they could not vote. The convention, the Revolutionary Congress, closed down all women's political associations and forbade women from debating men as equals. Olympe de Gouges' companions were sent to the lunatic asylum, and soon after her execution, it was the turn of Manon Holland. Manon was the wife of a minister of the government, but not even that could save her. She was found guilty of an anti-natural tendency to political activism. End of the quote. She had betrayed her feminine nature, which was to keep house and give birth to brave sons, and she had committed the deadly offense of sticking her nose into the masculine affairs of a state. And the guillotine dropped once more. Some of the evil friends I have, and I have a lot of evil friends, speaking about mirrors and so many stories of women oppression inside the book, asked me, and so, this system, in its infinite perversity, gave you a gift called Condoleezza Rice. With friends like that, I prefer my enemies. other invisibles. Official history has it that Vasco Núñez de Balboa was the first man to see from a summit in Panama the two oceans at once. Were the natives blind? Who first gave names to corn and potatoes and tomatoes and chocolate in the mountains and rivers of America? Who? Hernán Cortés, Francisco Pizarro? Were the natives mute? The pilgrims on the Mayflower heard him, God. God said America was the promised land. Were the natives deaf? And later on, the grandchildren of those pilgrims of the North, seized the name and everything else. Now they are the Americans. But those of us who live in the other Americas, who are we? Martians? I don't know. And other invisibles. Adam and Eve were black. The human voyage in the world began in Africa. From there, our ancestors set out to conquer the planet. Many paths led them to many destinies, and the sun took care of handing out colors from the palette. Now the rainbow of the earth is more colorful than the rainbow of the sky, but we all are, immigrants from Africa. Even the whitest of whites comes from Africa. Maybe we refuse to concede our common origin because racism causes amnesia, or because we find it simply unbelievable that in those days long past, the entire world was our kingdom, an immense map without borders. And our legs were the only passport required. This is almost unknown, and I think it had a very special meaning now that the United States have a black or half-black president. On ride the masked men, wrapped in white sheets, bearing white crosses, torches held high, mounted avengers of the virtue of ladies, and the honor of gentlemen, strike fear into Negroes hungering for damsels' white flesh. At the height of a wave of lynchings, D.W. Griffith's film, The Birth of a Nation, sings a hymn of praise to the Ku Klux Klan. This is Hollywood's first blockbuster and the greatest box office success ever for a silent movie. It is also the first film that ever opened at the White House. President Woodrow Wilson gives it a standing ovation. Applauding the film, he applauds himself. Wilson, the famous flag bearer of freedom, wrote most of the texts that accompany the epic images. The president's words explain that the emancipation of the slaves was, quote, a veritable overthrow of civilization in the South, the white South under the heel of the black South, end quote. Ever since, chaos reigns because blacks are, quote, men who knew none of the uses of authority except its insolences, end quote. But President Wilson lights the lamp of hope, quote, at last there had sprung into existence a great Ku Klux Klan, end quote. And even Jesus himself comes down from heaven at the end of the movie to give his blessing. Fortunately enough, this country has now a different president. Brunete, Spain, 1937. Oliver Law is black and red and a working man. He left Chicago to fight for the Spanish Republic in the ranks of the Lincoln Brigade. In the brigade, blacks do not form a separate regiment. For the first time in the history of the United States, whites and blacks mix. And for the first time in the history of the United States, white soldiers obey the orders of a black commanding officer. An unusual commander. When Oliver Law gives the order to attack, he does not watch his men through binoculars. He is the first to join the fight. But then all the volunteers in the international brigades are unusual. They do not fight to win medals or conquer land or capture oil wells. Sometimes Oliver wonders, since this Spanish war is a war between whites who for centuries have held us in slavery, why am I a Negro? Why am I here? And he answers, we came to wipe out the fascists. And laughing, he adds, as if it were a joke, some of us must die doing the job. In the Battle of Brunete, summer of 1937, Oliver Law takes a bullet in the breast. Homage to two of my masters, Mark Twain and Ambrose Bierce. Some months after invading Iraq, President George W. Bush said his mother had been the War of Philippines. Both wars were inspired from heaven. Bush disclosed that God had ordered him to act as he did. It was not clear enough which was how was it done, no? By mail, by fax, by phone, but that the way I don't know how, but that's the way it was. He said so, and he never lied, you know. So if he said it was God's order, it was God's order, clearly. He was always this Bush, so sincere. And a century beforehand, President McKinley also heard the voice from the great beyond. Quote, God told me that we could not leave the Filipinos to themselves. They were unfit for self-government. There was nothing left for us but to take them all and to educate them and uplift and civilize and Christianize them. End of the quote. Thus, the Philippines were liberated from the Filipino threat, and along the way, the United States also saved Cuba, Puerto Rico, Honduras, Colombia, Panama, Dominican Republic, Hawaii, Guam, Samoa. At the time, writer Ambrose Bierce revealed, war is God's way of teaching us geography. And his colleague, Mark Twain, leader of the Anti-Imperialist League, designed a new flag for the nation, featuring little skulls in place of stars. General Frederick Funston suggested Twain ought to be hanged for treason. Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn defended their father. And speaking about fathers, a story about the father of the computers. Because Mirrors is a book written as a homage to human diversity. And sexual diversity is part, an important part, of human diversity. And so each day when we turn on our computers, we should begin saying thank you to the father of the computers, Alan Turing. Working for British intelligence, Alan Turing helped shorten the Second World War when he invented a machine that could crack the impenetrable military codes used by Germany's high command. At that point, he had already dreamed up a prototype for an electronic computer and had laid out the theoretical basis for today's information systems. Later on, he led the team that built the first computer to operate with integrated programs. He played interminable chess games with the machine and asked it questions that drove it nuts. And he insisted that it should write him love letters. And the machine responded by emitting rather incoherent messages. But it was not a machine, not at all a machine. No, it was not a machine. Flesh and blood, Manchester police arrested him in 1952 for gross indecency. At the trial, Turing pled guilty to being a homosexual. To be set free, he agreed to undergo medical treatment to cure him of the affliction. Homosexuality was a crime and a sickness all at once. The bombardment of drugs left him impotent, and he grew breasts, and he stayed always indoors, no longer went to the university. He heard murmurs, felt stares drilling into his back. He had the habit of eating an apple before going to bed. One night, he injected cyanide into the apple he was about to eat. el amor que pasa, la vida que pesa, la muerte que pisa. Hay dolores inevitables, y así es nomás, y ni modo. Pero las autoridades planetarias agregan dolor al dolor, y encima nos cobran ese favor que nos hacen. En dinero contante y sonante pagamos cada día el impuesto al valor agregado, y en desdicha contante y sonante pagamos cada día el impuesto al dolor agregado. El dolor agregado se disfraza de fatalidad del destino, como si fueran la misma cosa, la angustia que nace de la fugacidad de la vida y la angustia que nace de la fugacidad del empleo. Love wanes, life wakes, death wastes. Some griefs are inevitable. That is the way it is, and not much can be done about it. But those in charge of the planet pile grief on top of grief and then charge us for the favor. We pay the value-added tax every day in cold, hard cash and every day in cold, hard misfortune. We pay the grief-added tax. The added sorrow comes disguised as fate or destiny, as if the anguish born of the fleeting life were the same as the anguish born of the fleeting jobs. Something about a symbol of our time, the wall. The Berlin Wall was on the news every day. From morning till night we read, saw, heard, the wall of shame, the wall of infamy, the iron curtain. In the end, this wall, which deserved to fall, fell. But other walls sprouted and continue sprouting across the world, even though they are much larger than the one in Berlin. We hear little or nothing about them. Little is said about the wall the United States is building along the Mexican border, and little is said about the barbed wire barriers surrounding the Spanish enclaves on the African coast. Practically nothing is said about the West Bank Wall, which perpetuates the Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands and will be 15 times longer than the Berlin Wall. And nothing at all is said about the Morocco Wall, which perpetuates the seizure of the Saharan homeland by the Kingdom of Morocco and is 60 times the length of the Berlin Wall. Why are some walls so loud and others mute? Who knows? I don't know. Sleeping, she saw us. Elena dreamed we were waiting in line at an airport. A long line where every passenger had under the arm the pillow on which he or she had slept the night before. The pillows were sent through a dream reading machine. The machine detected any dangerous dreams that threatened to disturb the peace. The 20th century was born proclaiming peace and justice, but it died bathed in blood and passed on a world much more unjust than the one it inherited. The 21st century, which also arrived heralding peace and justice, is following in its predecessor's footsteps. In my childhood, I was convinced that everything that went astray on earth ended up in the moon. But the astronauts found no sign of dangerous dreams or broken promises or hopes betrayed. If not on the moon, where might they be? Perhaps they were never misplaced. Perhaps they are in hiding here on earth, waiting, esperándonos, a nosotros, los humanitos. Darwin told us we are cousins of the apes, not the angels. And later on we learned we emerged from Africa's jungle and that no stork ever carried us from Paris. And not long ago we discovered that our genes are almost identical to those of mice. Now we can't tell if we are God's masterpiece or the devil's bad joke. We puny humans, exterminators of everything, hunters of our own, creators of the atom bomb, the hydrogen bomb, and the neutron bomb, which is the healthiest of all bombs, since it vaporizes people but leaves objects intact. We, the only animals who invent machines, the only ones who live at the service of the machines they invent, the only ones who devour their own home, the only ones who poison the water they drink and the earth that feeds them, the only ones capable of renting or selling themselves, or renting or selling their fellow humans, the only ones who kill for fun, the only ones who torture, the only ones who rape, and also, the only ones who laugh, the only ones who daydream, the ones who make silk from the spit of a worm, the ones who find beauty in rubbish, the ones who discover colors beyond the rainbow, the ones who nourish the voices of the world with new music, and who create words so that neither reality nor memory will be mute. Y también. Los únicos que ríen, los únicos que sueñan despiertos, los que hacen seda de la baba del gusano, los que convierten la basura en hermosura, los que descubren colores que el arco iris no conoce, los que dan nuevas músicas a las voces del mundo y crean palabras para que no sean mudas la realidad ni su memoria. Gracias. Take my papers because I am very absent-minded. I use a very good Uruguayan glue for my head because I used to lose it. And so each morning, la pego bien pegada. Well.
So I'll give you this. You can just speak. That's the limit.
Okay.
Okay, if you have una palabra, raise your hand. We'll get a mic to you. And who would like to start us off? Right here in front. If you could wait for the mic.
Se expresó bien bonito y me gustó porque también lo dijo en español y en inglés. Y es la primera vez que estoy aquí. Quise venirlo a ver en persona. Yo soy de Puerto Rico. Estaba leyendo el periódico. Y vi su nombre y quise venir a ver quién era el que escribía toda esa hermosura que tiene los libros. Y voy a comprarlo porque quiero saber más de esos libros que tiene, que son bien interesantes.
Gracias.
Es un honor estar aquí acerca de usted viéndolo. Que Dios le bendiga mucho.
Thank you. Thank you.
Another question. Yes, my Spanish is not very good. Right here in the second row.
Estaba leyendo en el comercio, el periódico peruano, comentarios de la gente acerca de cosas que pasaban en la política peruana. Y siempre había comentarios muy racistas sobre nosotros mismos. Y en cada uno de los comentarios siempre había esta cuestión de, no, es que es un indio, básicamente. ¿Usted cree que alguna vez podremos sobreponernos a ese lastre del colonialismo en nuestras tierras?
Sí, it would be possible to ask it in English because there are some people who doesn't speak Spanish, and it's a very interesting question. Yes.
It's so hard to speak English to you, but yeah, I was reading a comercio, which is a Peruvian newspaper, the other day, and there's always these commentaries that people do about political news. And there's always somebody saying about, you know, he gotta be an Indian, that's why he says so. Or, you know, probably your mother is a Serrana, somebody from the Andes. And it's so frustrating. I've been living here 20 years, and every time I come back to Peru, I want to believe that we are better, but we are not. And my question is, do you think that we are ever going to get over this self-hatred that we have for this colonial history that we share?
Yes, I hope so, but it will be very difficult because it would imply a deep cultural revolution. Begin after more than five centuries of scorn, begin to respect Indian cultures, the so-called Indian, called native cultures, and learn from them some lessons that I think come from long ago in time. Many centuries or millenniums ago, but are voices speaking to the future and helping a lot to build another possible world. For instance, the voices speaking about community, which is the opposite to globalization. Life-centered on solidarity and not in the values of the market. And voices speaking about the communion between we humans and nature, because we are part of nature. And therefore we are sisters and brothers of everything that have not only legs, but also roots, or wings, or patas, or aletas, or lo que sea. Because one of the problems of the ecological movements, and I am an ecologist indeed, no, without any doubt, is that there is a trend to look at nature as something different, like a postcard or a garden. And it's difficult to understand that we are nature, that we are part of nature. And therefore, all the crimes committed against nature are against ourselves. And we should defend the world because we are part of it, the natural world, because we are part of it. And for believing this, the Indians, all from the north to the south, were severely punished, and many of them died, burned or whipped to die. I was recently, 1 month and a half ago, in Mani. It's a place that I really wanted to know, wanted to be in, because I have written about it, but I had no idea how was it, Mani in Yucatan. A very important center of the Mayan culture. And there, in Mani, in the year 1562, an inquisitor, a Spanish inquisitor, called Fray Diego de Landa, burnt the Mayan memory. He burnt all the books he could get, some 3 or 4 codices, books were saved, but all the rest, and in the flames, to purify these lands previously conquered by Satan. This was what he said, that these lands were the private property of the demon, a sort of sucursal, how would you say, filial of the hell. And this is, well, fortunately enough, some days after my visit, 42 priests of the same order, Franciscana, of San Francisco de Assis, made there a ceremony of desagravio. I don't know the translation of the word desagravio, which is much more than begging pardon, or much more than this. A desagravio to the Mayan culture and to the Mayan roots of Guatemala, Yucatan, and all this part of America, and of the Mayan wisdom, because they were great astronomers and they discovered the zero before the Arabs had the gentle act of teaching it to Europe. And they had a wonderful vision of the world and of community life and everything. It was such a rich culture, unbelievably rich. And this was the proof that Satan was doing a good job here, that Satan was working well in America, so. It's a long, long history, and it's still alive, I mean. Racism is still present in almost all American countries, from north to south. Sometimes hidden, dissimulated, but it's present there. And that's why Evo Morales has caused such a scandal.
A few more questions, right in the front row here.
Hello, Mr. Galliano. I see you in the Montevideo 20 years ago in Parque Rodó. You remember? No. You remember Parque Rodó? Okay. Only... Yes. No. Yes. I need say thank you for your friendly with Mario Benedetti. I'm from Uruguay. Thank you.
Another question. Yeah, third row right here.
A long time ago, I read Las Venas Abiertas de América Latina, the open veins of Latin America, and it kind of opened my eyes to things that were around me that I wasn't aware of coming from South America. How do you see things now compared to the way they were when you wrote the book? Because now it has become a bestseller as a result of the gesture that was done in a recent meeting, which we are so proud and happy that it happened, because now other people have the opportunity to read. But how do you see, has it been a progress towards good, or what comments do you have from when you wrote it to the way things are now?
I think there is a good sign. There are good signs in several countries in the sense of defending their natural resources, and this was the main objective. I mean, the main reason to write Open Veins of Latin America, to show how Latin American countries have been despojados, stolen, vaciados, emptied from the richness, and the richness became a source of poverty, something like a damnation, doomed to be poor and to be humiliated because they had the misfortune of standing up over rich lands and rich subsoils. And now there is a growing conscience that this should be stopped, and that we are obliged to defend the remains of our natural resources after five centuries of pillage. No? But something is still there, and we should use it for public happiness and not for to build our own disgrace. Because natural resources are there. And when they are gone, they don't even say, thank you, it was a pleasure.
I see many more hands than we have time to call on. Back here on our left, Deborah, please wait for the mic. Lady in red.
I have a question also about Open Veins of Latin America. So as you mentioned, Chavez gave Obama the book. What do you hope that Obama, if he actually reads it, would learn from your book?
No idea. I have no idea. Really, no idea. What I know is that the book had a very strange history. At the beginning, nobody read it. It went unnoticed during 1 year. Nobody knew that this book existed. And many, many years before this generous act of President Chavez, there were very good marketing experts doing a great job to diffuse Open Veins. These people were the military dictators of Latin America who prohibited it, forbade the book, and burnt it. And it was perfect. The book suddenly became a bestseller everywhere. And I'm so grateful to them. Except in my own country, because our militaries had not been trained to take power, to seize power, and so their cultural level was not so high as in other countries in the art of extermination and so on. And that's why during 5 or 6 months, the first 5 or 6 months of the military dictatorship in Uruguay, Open Veins could enter freely in the military jails because the censor saw the title Open Veins and thought it was a textbook on anatomy and a medicine, and the medicine books were not forbidden, and so it entered into this series. But afterwards, after 5 or 6 months, they realized it was a mistake.
A few more on our right, about 7 rows back here.
Hi, I would like to know what message you can give to the youth, a los jóvenes latinoamericanos ahora. Thank you.
Could you repeat the question, please?
Would you please?
Yes, I would like to know what message, un mensaje, you can give to the youth, a los jóvenes latinoamericanos.
Un mensaje.
Un mensaje, or an advice. Now, I don't know.
When somebody comes and says, Eduardo, I have an advice to give you, I said, no, please, no. I have received showers of advices all along my life. Please, please, déjame en paz. It's if we are all trained by this USA habit, it's not a good habit, of feeling or thinking or knowing that this nation had been chosen by God to save other nations, and so they would have the perfect receta. How is it? Receta. Eh? Recipe. The perfect recipe to save countries and save peoples. And each time they have saved a country in Latin America, they left military dictatorships during 20 years, 30 years, like in Dominican Republic, in Nicaragua, everywhere. Everywhere, nations saved by them turned to become giant jails and cemeteries. So what I would say is, please don't save me. I don't want to be saved.
Got time for one more. Lady in blue, about 10 rows back here. She's right standing up there.
Compañero, lo voy a traducir también en inglés, pero bien brevemente, ¿qué piensa de la postura de los países del ALBA y latinoamericanos y centroamericanos sobre Cuba, sobre todo en las últimas reuniones de la OEA? Usted dice en varias ocasiones que no es un historiador, pero no ha habido un libro de historia tan bueno como Las Venas Abiertas. In English. I'm asking, what is his position on the Latin America and the ALBA countries, particularly in respect to Cuba, on the OAS meetings that have been held recently? Thank you.
Yes, I think that now there are opening doors everywhere, no? Inside Cuba, outside Cuba, in the neighboring countries, as part of a wave of new energies that you can find nowadays in all over Latin America, energies of change and energies of dignity and solidarity. And I have never hidden some divergences I have with the direction of the Cuban Revolution, because I don't think I don't feel and I don't think that the omnipotence of the state should be the only possible answer to the omnipotence of the market. But I am also sure that Cuba has been a source of inspiration for all of us in that two matters, dignity and solidarity, which are not usual. unfortunately are not very useful in the modern world. Recuerdo un graffiti que leí una vez en Montevideo, muy cruel, terrible, que decía, yo no vendo a mi madre, ya la vendió mi padre. Y entonces, eso era un poco el resumen de lo que el mundo aconseja, ¿no? Y me parece que Cuba, con todos sus defectos, abrió un camino diferente. Bueno, muchas gracias.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.